As I think about Hanukkah, it's like, what will be to actually light in public? And what does it mean to share our light in a way that doesn't limit it to the Judaic narrative, certainly not the Maccabean one of military might, but to promote the story of the meaning of light as a recurring, emerging phenomena.
You're listening to Contact Chai with me, Rabbi Lizzie Heideman. This is a podcast dedicated to inspired, down-to-earth Jewish spirituality in conversation. Last spring, we began with a series about Passover and the transformative power of ritual. Over the summer, we dove into the themes of the saddest holiday on the calendar, Tisha B'Av, and explored the value and the challenges of honoring exile, destruction, and renewal. And now, as we approach the light-filled winter holiday of Hanukkah, we begin a new series. This multi-show series, Lies and Lessons, is a deep dive into the mythology, the liturgy, the practices, and the history of Hanukkah, a rarely overlooked but often misunderstood Jewish holiday. We begin our conversations with the esteemed rabbi and scholar, and my friend, Rabbi Amichai Lau-Levi. Rabbi Amichai is the founding director of Storytelling, Inc., and the spiritual leader of Lab Shul, a God-optional, artist-driven experimental community in New York City, and, like Mishkan, part of the Jewish Emergent Network. As an Israeli-born Jewish educator, writer, and performance artist, Amichai brings a unique lens and an innovative approach to old and familiar traditions, which is why we begin our series here, speaking with him about the symbolism of the Hanukkah lights. Hope you enjoy it.
Well, first of all, everything must change, as Nina Simone taught us, and everything evolves. And I think probably, as we all know, because of Christmas and its hold on the imagination, Hanukkah in America, and therefore in Europe and to a degree now in Israel, has increased in size, and the 8 nights of gifts became a way to deal with the Santa anxiety. That's all cute, and obviously not the main point of this holy night season. But Hanukkah is on people's radar in ways that Purim isn't and Shavuot isn't, and, you know, so many other important fasts and feasts are not. Whatever the reason, I think it's immaterial. The fact is, it is an opportunity for people to come together, to connect deeper to the metaphor of light, to the notion that when it gets cold and when it gets dark, physically and metaphysically, we have tools to overcome the distance. And in the middle of a pandemic, when we are feeling, for all the right and horrible reasons, disconnected, anxious, afraid, and for many of us home alone, we've got this. So we have tools in our disposal.
So a second ago, you connected Hanukkah, Christmas, Kwanzaa. Usually Diwali is part of that, you know, seasonal holiday representation, which is sort of shorthand for this is a season of religions around the world recognizing that in a dark time of year, we need light. Do you feel like is the particularly Jewish contribution to all of these different cultural and religious ways of bringing light into dark times?
I've had a journey with Hanukkah. I grew up with Hanukkah as a story many of us know, that on the one hand, it's the militaristic victory of the Maccabees, and growing up in Israel, that was and is a big deal. It is about the victory of the few against the many, and it's the triumph of our people, and it's about religious freedom, and it's about political power. And that's the Maccabees that are now these little cute chocolate-covered things. And then the other story is, of course, the little jar of oil that could, and the miracle of light that survived, and the menorah was lit, and again, against all odds. Now, the older I got, the more I was suspicious about, well, which of these narratives is the story? And of course, the rabbis in the Talmud asked the same question. What is this holiday? So I was doing a lot of research, and actually my research at some point, this is some 30 years ago, I got curious about, I think Hanukkah in that year, in the early 90s, Hanukkah fell on Christmas, as it sometimes does. And on Christmas Eve, December 24th, I found out there's a Hasidic tradition called Nittl. My father told me about. Now, Nittl is something that happens less so now, but was big in the shtetl days, where on Christmas Eve, you do not step outside, you don't study Torah, you play card games, and you kind of keep chill. It's like a minor holiday, but not really. On the one hand, it is obviously counter Christmas, because if you're living in Eastern Europe and it's a heavy Catholic town, then Christmas Eve might not be the safest time for a Jew to step outside. But why not study Torah? And what do the card games? So I began researching and went down a wormhole. This is pre-Google, that this goes back to the medieval period or even earlier. And the word Nittl might be Yiddish, but it's probably come from Natalis, which is birth. And it actually connects to pre-Christmas. December 24th, only in the 11th century, was declared as the birth of Christ and that holiday. But earlier than that, the date that that was celebrated as December 24th was the solstice, the longest night of the year, which now is December 21st. But it's only around the 11th century that it was moved to the 21st and was disconnected from what it originally was, which is now Christmas. And there's interesting Talmudic like footnotes about like, where's Hanukkah and is it connected to the longest night of the year? Well, we know that Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, the two schools of thought in the Talmud, argue about do you light eight up or eight down. There's one tradition that says there was eight nights before the longest night of the year and eight nights after the longest night of the year. And they would light candles going up and then going down. And so there's all these traditions in our tradition that actually point at the possibility that once upon a time, pre-Maccabees, if that happened, pre-little jar that could, if that happened, pre-Christmas, and I know less about Kwanzaa or Holi, you know, or Diwali, but like the notion that the longest night of the year is the ancient human moment of anxiety and crisis, certainly pre-electricity, that led to these ritualized way of magnifying the power of light to ignite our hope and warm us up literally and figuratively. I suspect that's the origin of Hanukkah and Christmas, which is a whole different story. But if you ask me what does Judaism have to offer, what does Hanukkah have to offer here? First, it's the richness of mythology, that we have evolved this phenomenal set of stories. B, survival. This holiday is still around. Maccabees aren't, nor are the Greeks, or whatever thing. But that story about hope and those eight nights of you can do it, that survived. We can talk more about the dreidel as a symbol for circular optimism. But I think it's really just that in every tradition, we have this perpetual archetype of honoring the darkness and celebrating the light.
I'm thinking about the various halachot of Hanukkah, like the practices, at least the way that the rabbis sort of tease them apart, you know, in the Talmud, which are not consistent, actually. Like you mentioned one of the debates, you know, do we light candles going eight nights up, starting with one, going to eight? Or do we actually start with eight and go down to one? You know, and there's a debate about it. And then at the end of the day, we go with Hillel, we start with one and we go to eight because, of course, like we need to amplify, magnify, grow the light, not diminish the light, not shrink the light. And so there's the idea that you put the Chanukiah in a visible place. Like when I was growing up, we put the Chanukiah on the dining room table. That was where we did it. My family gathered around the Chanukiah. My family was one of those families that like this was basically the only ritual my parents knew how to do. And like, God bless them for doing it. I actually think it really contributed to building a sense within myself of like being part of the Jewish people. And we did it around the dining room table. It was much later that I learned that actually, if it's safe, you're supposed to put the Chanukiah on your front window or like on your front porch or in a place where people will see it. What is that about? Why?
Well, I think the original is Pirsumei Nisa, to promote the miracle, to public relations, to the miracle of light and to the power of standing up to oppression, which is for the same reason you have nativity scenes or, you know, they're going to start hanging up all those lights out in the streets. I think Pirsumei Nisa is the original. We know that from the teachings, and you have very specifics of where it goes in the window and outside. And I absolutely remember as a child that the whole thing where I was growing up was putting it by the window. And then because I was growing up in Israel, you would actually have this game of seeing who's got theirs and where is it and how many they have. And of course, till today, you go to Jewish areas or in Israel. And that's part of the beauty of Hanukkah. I remember, I think I was there last year. You just go out and yeah, there they are everywhere. So I think it's the sense of publicity for the sake of promotion of fill in the blank. Our military might, our historical survival, the fact that the few can make a difference in a world hostile to the viewpoints and hopes we have. And just again, the joy of seeing the lights on, like the notion of a lighthouse. And I think the reasons why it went indoors in many cases is because of fear, either of being in areas where not friendly to Jewish public existence, or just fire codes, like it's not the right place. So it's an interesting challenge for us in 2020. What does promoting Hanukkah look like so that I can share my light and that you can see that I share your light? Well, for a lot of us, that's going to be on Zoom. Regardless of what I'm going to light here in Harlem for my neighbors to see, we have this new digital opportunity, which we've been playing with for the last few years, you know, in many ways. But now, interesting creative challenge. I don't have a response yet to it. We'll figure it out.
Yeah, it's interesting. I want to say that when thinking about this this theme of like shining your light, your special, unique Jewish light, putting it in the window, letting all your non-Jewish neighbors see. Because it's one thing when you're sharing and everybody's sharing, you know? So it's like, I don't know, I think of there's a particular street where I grew up, Harper in Hyde Park, where like everybody puts out Halloween decorations. And so like everybody's in on the game and everybody's houses are decked out. I know there are certain neighborhoods where, you know, it's the same thing with Christmas lights. And I never lived in a neighborhood where the same was true of like menorahs in windows. You know, if you saw a menorah in the window, that was a special different thing. There's like, a sort of subversive, David and Goliath, but like you're the minority putting something out in the window and saying we're different, and hopefully in doing that you're being appreciated and celebrated, or at the very least like people aren't attacking you for being different. And we know stories over the years of when it hasn't been safe to do that, and the Talmud takes into account some of those cases and says like, if it's not safe, go ahead, put it in your dining room table. Like don't put yourself at risk, right? Like don't put yourself at risk in order to shine your light. Like your light is special and beautiful, but like if it's not safe to shine it, you just go ahead and bring it inside. But I was thinking about talking with you specifically about this, partially because of your own journey of actually like growing up in an environment where you, Amichai Lau Levi, like your light was constricted in a certain way. And coming, you know, into a new version of your rabbinate leadership vision as an adult with, you know, your whole journey. I'm wondering, I don't know, just from your own life, what does it actually mean to shine your light, you know, in an environment maybe where that's actually not so welcome? And then in an environment where it is welcome, you know, how does a person take this lesson and internalize it?
So as you're speaking, Lizzie, I'm thinking of these last weeks where, you know, you'd walk around in New York and you'd see a political sign in the window. Because I'm in New York City, it was mostly for the party that I'm in favor of. And it's like this, oh, yeah. Or I'm thinking of, where was I recently where I was very surprised to see a rainbow flag in the window in the neighborhood? Oh, when I was just in Philadelphia right now, I was in the polling. I was walking around as a poll volunteer for a few days, and I was in Northwest Philly in a bunch of neighborhoods. And there were these rainbow flags every once in a while. And mostly political stuff was mostly blue. And it's a sense of, okay, here I am. It's vulnerable. I'm putting myself out. I'm telling you that Black Lives Matter, or the trans lives matter, or that I'm putting the rainbow flag up. And here I am, spreading the love, sharing the story, promoting the messaging that matters to me. And what's it like to do so as a Jew or as somebody who's queer, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the public messaging of putting the menorah in your window is analogous to those type of statements. But it's not just about political or social views, but it's really about originally the religious, the spiritual faith. Light triumphs. We believe in the power of light. It's it's like having a bumper sticker that, you know, whether it's a fish or crescent or whatever, right? It coexists. So I'm thinking about that and where throughout my life, there were a couple of times in my life where I felt unsafe to have a menorah in my window. Mostly when I was traveling, when I was in Budapest one winter, when I was in Palestine working one winter many, many years ago. I was like, is this a good idea or not? And therefore the privatization of the ritual takes it into another landscape of proximity and making it known, which is whoever's in the room with you. It just like adjusts the reach in many ways, but it's still about publicizing a thought. Like by lighting a candle, you're taking it from an idea into an object. Like literally you change the lighting. I am curious about this year. I think I'm going to be mostly in New York. I mean, we'll see how we go with COVID, but I'm really hoping to go visit my mother in Israel. And there's this project I've been involved with in Greece, a refugee school that's been closed now for about a year. And I had a thought of going. But as I think about Hanukkah, it's like, what will be to actually light in public? And what does it mean to share our light in a way that doesn't limit it to the Judaic narrative? Certainly not the Maccabean one of military might, but to promote the story of the meaning of light as a recurring, emerging phenomena. As the long nights are real every year, they also get shorter. And when we light a candle in a dark room, we make it brighter. And darkness isn't evil. Mm-hmm. It's just part of the story.
You're also making me think of, like, if the purpose for putting the menorah out in the window, as the rabbis of the Talmud say, is persumei nisa, like publicizing, putting it out there, showing people, you know, sort of making your personal ritual public for the purpose of public consumption, visibility. So you could actually ask, well, then what's the point of doing it if I'm not showing it to the world? Like if that was the point, then like, what does it matter if I do it on my own dining room table? But, you know, sort of from my experience and from what it sounds like what you were describing in Budapest or anywhere else where you actually took the act of lighting a candle by yourself in a room without anybody there, it's really, like identity boosting in a sense, you know, like I am doing this thing, not for anybody else, but actually because this matters to me. And something about the resonance of whether it's the holiday, being Jewish, survival, standing up for who I am in a place where maybe that doesn't really feel safe, but knowing that that's beautiful and I affirm who I am in this place, and lighting that candle and saying that blessing and saying also the blessing for Sha'asa Nisim Lavotenu, that like you did miracles for our ancestors, but also for me right now. That there's something character building about that in some really meaningful way. That's actually really important. I'm thinking about a service where a couple of years ago, like early days Mishkan, when on Friday nights, like I don't know. We used to do like half an hour of text study in the middle of services. I'm like thinking like, when did we stop doing that? Why did we stop doing that? And I think it was because enough people said to me, like, I don't want text study. I just want you to tell me what it means. But early days, we would do like a good half an hour, 45 minutes of actually like digging into text. And we studied at Hanukkah this text about Pirsumei Nisa. And there were many queer people in the room who stood up and reading this for the first time were like, this is so important for me to hear and to know that, like, shining my light, being myself, being out about who I am is a mitzvah. Like, that is actually, that is a mitzvah. And that is, you know, it's sort of like you were talking about the pride flags in the window, but, you know, not being ashamed of who I am in order to fit in, I think is still really powerful, like wherever, whoever. But especially if you're kind of, you know, if you're not the mainstream, if you're, you know, taking this bold, courageous act of being different.
Yeah. Reminds me, there's this photograph, famous photograph. I'm aware that as we are recording this today, tomorrow is November 9th, which is Kristallnacht, the terrible night of the broken glass that really marks the beginning of the Holocaust. And there's this famous photo of a menorah standing in the window in some Berlin
yes
apartment, and across the street is a big Nazi flag. But the menorah is there, and you're thinking, what must it have been like to have Hanukkah in 1938 and in 1939, 40? I mean, I know for my father's, my mother's, my parents and grandparents, you know, they've gone through it. But here we are, we're still around, lighting candles. So there is this sense of the courage and the creativity of saying, here we are and shining our light. I also want to say there is something, I'm taking it back into the internal, beyond the Jewish. Mm-hmm. It's an exercise in contemplating impermanence and this, again, the dance of the flames and just being present while the dark is getting darker and the winter is getting colder. I have this memory that I think I've shared before in some context, 3 or 4 winters ago. It's a long story, but I had a terrible breakup mid-Hanukkah with someone that I was very much in love with. And we both had a big temper and boom, it's like we're in some house away in the middle of nowhere. And it's the 4th or 5th night and he just drove off. And I was there by myself without a car, nowhere to go. I think we just broke up. We did. Completely heartbroken. I had my menorah with me and a bottle of bourbon. Pretty much it. And Netflix. Mm-hmm. And I was going to be there for the next 4 days and 4 nights. And what I ended up doing was I lit that menorah that night in tears. And I sat and I just looked at the flames. And I said, my practice is going to be to not look away from the candles until the very last one goes. And that was a couple of hours of like really trying to meditate on the light. Don't get sucked into the darkness. Be in the light, be in the light, be in the light. And I did that the next few nights as well. And that and the bourbon and Netflix and meditation and whatever. It was very, very helpful. But that became not about the outside. It not become having a conversation with anybody else. It was about the internal activation of this technology, of these nights of reminding myself, refueling my hope, my ability to be hopeful, to whatever. So I think everything in our tradition has all these different levels of how you want to activate them. Is it about Jewish continuity? Is it about, you know, is it about the dark? Is it about the solstice? Yeah, of course, pick and choose. And even in our tradition, there's a few different reasons for Hanukkah, and there's a few different blessings, and a few different conflicting narratives. And we're at a moment, of course, where the intra-spiritual and the notion of contemplation is yet again important in ways that perhaps was not as important for the mainstream of Jewish practice only recently.
Yeah, but that makes it even that much more sort of like surprising and, I don't know, simultaneously surprising and unsurprising, because the rabbis, I feel like, you know, they say things and you think they're just being ritualistic or dogmatic, but actually they probably knew what you were saying, like the insistence that you not use these candles to like read or to do other things, you not use the candles for something, but actually you just enjoy them. You know, and that's sort of built into the description of, you know, Hanero Talalu Anu Madlikim, we light these candles and then we enjoy them. And Hanukkah candles are not like, I don't know, they sell Shabbat candles that are like really tall, which I don't totally understand because they burn for hours and hours and hours long after you go to bed. Hanukkah candles are like these relatively small little guys that go for half an hour, 45 minutes, and they burn out. And that's intentional because you're supposed to do exactly what you just described, like really give yourself that half an hour, 45 minutes, whatever it is, to just be with the light. And the light is so different. You know, the sun has set, it's dark. You could like go ahead and turn out the lights in your house and really have a profound experience of the difference between one light and two lights and three lights and four lights and five lights and six. You know, I mean, just every single night, if you give yourself that, what a powerful opportunity for insight, you know, or just for experience. Like, how often do any of us do that? I mean, like what you're describing right now, like the possibility of taking the light of your phone and like shoving it in a bag somewhere else, you know, and actually being with the light of one candle on night one.
It's astonishing that I mean, you and I have been, you know, part of this in some way, that in so many, many Jewish context, you have a big Hanukkah candle lighting, whatever, the mayor, the this, the that, the family. And then you light it and everybody goes and
yes,
does their own thing.
Totally.
And the menorah is just like there. And I'm like, no.
No, it's like the menorah is like calling out, like, hello, I'm right here. The whole action is right here.
Right.
Yeah.
It's just about changing the focus.
Yeah. You mentioned the dreidel a second ago as like circle and, you know, with symbolism. So I have to admit, I always just thought the dreidel was, you know, an adaptation of some probably German or European game where we spin a top, and that was probably, you know, and the Hebrew letters on the sides of the dreidel were just the way of making it Jewish. Nes gadol, hayah sham, hayah po. Great miracle happened there or here, but wherever it was, it, you know, that was sort of like a Jewish wrapping on top of a game that probably didn't originate with this holiday. Can you spiritualize this for us? Is this really, what can this be about?
I mean, game theory is important. Games are portals into values in ways that data isn't. And the Svivon of the dreidel is one of those little winks. And there's lots of interesting theories where it came from. What I like about it, and I've been thinking about it, is that the Svivon or the dreidel not only has different names in different languages, it also is a different object, whether you live in Israel or you live in the diaspora. They're all made in China, most likely. But if you get one that was made anywhere and is meant for played, for being played in anywhere but in Israel, it's going to say Nun Gimel Hey Shin, Nes Gadol Hayasham. A great miracle happened there. If you're playing it in Israel, it's going to say Nes Gadol Hayah Po, a great miracle happened here. That is a 20th century invention. Some Zionists, we don't know who, took this Svivon, that the letters are from a German gambling game. Nicht ganz half schoen. Nothing, everything.
Half.
Half, and again. Right, it's like a gambling game, and somebody's like, "Ooh, let's Jewify it," and then some Zionists were like, "What do you mean there? Here we are, back in the land. Here, there's no other object that typifies and symbolizes the reality of here and there." And I like to only use the one that says here, because everywhere I am is miracle. Mm-hmm. It's not about Zion. It's not about Israel. It's not about the Maccabees. It's about play. It's about here. Wherever it falls right now, boom, you are here.
Nes gadol hayapo.
Yeah, it's always po. It's always po. It's not just haya, it's hove po. So there's a way to spiritualize even that silly little toy.
As long as we're talking about the actual, you know, sort of symbolism that gets mapped onto the rituals, is there anything else that you've found to be really meaningful, or that if people were listening and were being introduced to Hanukkah by you right now, you would really want them to know?
Resist the urge to go over the top with the candles, with a gift. I'm sorry. I know I got three kids and it's all like, you guys, come on. And I know a lot of us have creative solutions about that, from being charitable to little gestures, but that's over the top. I never had that as a kid. I think taking the candles seriously in some creative ways is beautiful. I just took out my menorah from the closet. I was like, oh, time to start having you around and have intention on it. Even during COVID, do not underestimate the gastro-Judaic. Our taste buds is where a lot of meaning resides. So whatever oily carb is your go-to, those are important, and a lot of joy. And I hope there will be some opportunities for us this winter, wherever and however we are isolated or connected, to enjoy some of those. And I think one of my hopes this year is, as we are, I mean, for the Lab Shul community and many people who have joined us these past months from across the world, to make this an opportunity not to celebrate our story at the expense of your story, mm-hmm. our survival and not your survival, the Jews versus the Greeks, because that story is problematic. Like whoever the Maccabeans would have been in those days, they opposed the kind of culture that you and I celebrate. We are one with the Western world. We have many problems with patriarchy and with being, you know, part of the sort of white supremacy of the Judeo-Christian narrative. And we have problems with so many of these narratives we've been bought into, and being different and celebrating our differences is powerful. But it's not an end, you know, an either or end game for me, this tribal fight. Which is part of the Maccabean story, and that's certainly what happens in the preschools. So to find a way to still celebrate Hanukkah for what it means without getting caught up in its minority politics, anxiety, trauma game, but like understand that that's part of it, and we're lucky to still be here. But to share our light means to share our light with everyone and for everyone, and not as apart from everyone. So there's a lot of redemptive possibilities here.
Thank you so much, Amichai. This was short and powerful. I'm so grateful for your friendship and for being in this holy band of Jewish Emergent Network rabbis with you, so that we could have this time together to talk about Hanukkah. Thank you.
I'm very honored and so grateful that you got me now thinking, all right, let's go. Hanukkah 2020.
Hanukkah 2020.
Yeah, spark wonder now.
Amen.
You've been listening to Contact Chai, a podcast from Mishkan Chicago, an independent Jewish spiritual community that's part of the Jewish Emergent Network. This show is produced by our fabulous team at Mishkan. Editing and production of this podcast is by Hannah Rehak, administrative assistance by Zach Weinberg, and editorial oversight by our Director of Communications, Ashley Donahue. Find out more about Mishkan Chicago at www.mishkanchicago.org, where you can also make a donation. And if you feel so inspired, please subscribe and leave a review. We want to hear from you. Hamon brachot, many blessings. See you soon.